Mr. Decker, good morning.
Good to see you again, Judge Henderson, Judge Kavanaugh, Judge Brown. I've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. What I'd like to emphasize in my argument today, Your Honor, is that the government did not conclusively rebut our showing that trial counsel below was ineffective. Perhaps the best way to do it is to explain briefly the two theories of the case. The prosecutor's theory of the case was, if I can allude to a political campaign of a long time ago, there he goes again. He was a pedophile in 2006. He's a pedophile in 2008. The defense theory of the case didn't deny that he was a pedophile, but said that he was bisexual. And in this particular event, he was looking for a hookup, a male hookup, because that was the easiest way of getting sexual release on the internet. As it stood, the defense case was effectively uncorroborated. Why was it uncorroborated? The record shows, there's evidence in the record, that defense counsel knew of at least three people that he could have called to support the defense theory of the case. And because it was uncorroborated, I should add the prosecutor very adroitly seized on that in her closing argument, pointed it out to the jury. One of the people that the record shows that was aware of a situation that defense counsel had contacted was a gentleman named Frederick Boleyn, who's a widely published and credentialed scholar, a student of sexual disorders, specifically called paraphilia. And what Dr. Boleyn would have opined is as follows, that he'd examined Brandon Lawrie's at the jail. It was no secret that he was involved in the case. I mean, Judge Robertson below had agreed to fund Mr. Lawrie's defense of an expert. The problem was that Dr. Boleyn got sent down the wrong avenue. What defense counsel appears to have done was try to get him to opine on the issue of specific intent. But we know from the Arndt decision in this circuit that you can't do that, and properly so. What he should have focused Dr. Boleyn on was this following simple issues. Does he suffer from paraphilia? The answer to that, Dr. Boleyn would have opined, is yes. Number two, what is paraphilia? He would have educated the jury that paraphilia is a disorder, sexual disorder, that's characterized, among other things, by pedophilia. But, and this is critical to understand, that a pedophile can have sexual relations with an adult, such as Mr. Lawrie testified that he was seeking to do here with respect to Detective Palchak. And thirdly, Dr. Boleyn would have testified that paraphiliacs who cruise the internet for sex tend to make the most outlandish, outrageous statements, which would have been consistent with the defense theory of the case and would have educated the jury on the nature of the disease that Mr. Lawrie suffered from.
Was Dr. Boleyn prepared to testify as you've described at the time of the trial, or is this something that you learned later?
No, Your Honor. First of all, the record evidence shows that Dr. Boleyn was brought into the case, I believe, in July of 2009. The trial wasn't until April 2010. He visited Mr. Lawrie's at the jail and supplied medical records. It is evident from the status conferences in the record that defense counsel, defense counsel below, was trying to have him opine on the issue of specific intent. I also want to make this representation that is not in the brief. It's based on my review of the records. It's not even clear that he was given notice of the exact trial date. But what is really clear to us, based on my conversation based on the record as well as my discussion with Dr. Boleyn, which I have got to do as part of this attack on direct appeal, that he would have opined to that. He was prepared to opine, but he was a paraphiliac. There's no doubt in his mind about that. And he's widely published in the field. And I cited some of his articles in our opening brief.
Is there any explanation in the record for trial counsel's decision not to file something? Because the trial judge did give him an opportunity to do that.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think you've hit on the heart of the issue here. There's nothing that shows us why trial counsel made. I would say that there's no decision not to call him. There's nothing in the record that shows us why this happened. If there were something in the record, it would be helpful. But that's the problem for the government. They can't conclusively show that trial counsel made a decision not to call Dr. Boleyn.
Well, I thought the district court said we waited long enough and we've got to try this case.
I think what the district court said, Your Honor, is I need to get him here one way or another. I need to know what's going on. Right. And there's no real clear explanation in the record as to what was going on and why. There is a clear understanding, I think, from the record, we can all agree, that he was focused. He had Dr. Berlin focused on the wrong, going down the wrong track. What specific intent? But as part of what Dr. Berlin knew, based on his discussions with Mr. Lawrie's, is that he was a paraphiliac, and he was also bisexual, and would have opined, he would have testified to the nature of his disease. It's a mushy record. It's a really mushy record.
Well, don't we usually have the district court consider that kind of claim in the first instance then?
I think this case should be remanded to the district court to consider that, Judge. There's evidence in the record that Dr. Berlin was involved in the case, but there's no clear indication in the record of why he wasn't called.
Is there anything in the record about what he would have said, though?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is there anything in the record about what he would have said? I thought your position was trial counsel didn't even say, make any sort of proffer.
I think in the record there was an indication that he had him examining the issue of specific intent. I believe that's in the status conference, but otherwise there's nothing in the record. That's the problem that I'm faced with. I mean, apart from having talked to Dr. Berlin and reviewed his correspondence with defense counsel, there is just nothing in the record. Where I've got the same problem with Mr. Lum, a somewhat similar problem with respect to the lay witnesses, Mr. Stickney, who was clearly, he brought a writ of habeas corpus to bring him in, but it was brought untimely. Now, the government's position is there was another strategic decision, but that doesn't make sense. He subpoenaed Mr. Stickney to come to trial. Now, Mr. Stickney, I should point out, there's evidence in the record, at least what Mr. Lawrie's ended up said at his sentencing argument, the government quite properly quotes that he would have testified as to the meaning of some of these phrases that I suggest you were clearly homoerotic that were used in the chat in question. Mr. Stickney knew Brandon Lawrie's, and they had engaged, they'd sought one another for sex and was familiar with the argot used in these sort of chats, such as discreet, down low, and most importantly, quote, perv out. But the problem.
Would these two men actually corroborate or would they contradict the defendant? Because the defendant got on the stand, as I recollect, and said that he was a homosexual to the extent that he was as a last resort, that he described in painstaking detail what his real urges were and what he was primarily interested in. And so would these witnesses that didn't appear have really corroborated or contradicted him if they said, no, he was clearly a homosexual? I mean, he himself was saying, I've done this, but this is something that I do as a last resort.
I think that's what the record does suggest, that if he couldn't find release anywhere else, Mr. Lawrie was prepared to have sex with men, but that's homoerotic. That's being bisexual. He said he had a girlfriend, but when he was trolling the net, for lack of a better phrase, seeking anonymous sex, typically the only way he was going to get quick anonymous sex, or release, I believe is his term, that he was through dealing with men, because women, I think he referred to Angelina Jolie, said he didn't think he was going to have any luck finding her on the internet, but he'd find men. So the problem, these three witnesses, certainly Dr. Berlin would have been critical to for the jury to understand the insidious nature of this disease, how it affects people. Mr. Stickney had correspondence about hooking up, of having sexual encounter with Mr. Lawrie's on the internet. They'd corresponded with one another, and he would have corroborated what Mr. Lawrie's testified about the meaning of these phrases, like let me focus on perv out. Detective Palchak was impeached at trial. That was the fictional Jim, the intermediary who was supposedly arranging sex with a 12-year-old girl. He had no idea when he was first questioned at the preliminary hearing what perv out meant. Mr. Lawrie testified what perv out meant was two guys getting together watching extreme fantasy, and I think he said at a sentencing hearing it specifically was kiddie porn. But There was nobody called to corroborate. There was nobody there to corroborate Mr. Lawry's. And the prosecutor, as I pointed out in her cross, said, he's uncorroborated. Of course he's got an interest in saying this.
I thought the detective did admit that some of these other phrases, down low and things like that, were homosexual phrases.
Oh, I think that the, what, let's start with down low. I think that Palchak was sort of going everywhere on what down low was. And there was the issue of what discreet meant. There was some testimony in the record that discreet tended to mean men seeking other men. And pervert, which was, there was, Palchak had no idea really what that meant. But Mr. Lawrence testified as to what his, what that meant, and it just was left without anybody to support him. That's the problem that, that he had. So the government was able to say here that, yes, Mr. Stickney, he's a despicable person, so is Mr. Lombard. I'll stipulate to that. But all day, all along downstairs in the district court, the government puts on despicable people in support of its case. I mean, who would know the defendant better than people like this? But he was left without any corroboration at trial. So our view of it is the Sixth Amendment guarantees him effective assistance of counsel. He didn't have the effective assistance of counsel. Counsel did a really good job cross-examining Detective Palchak. I want to say that here and now. I think that's clear to all of us. But ultimately, Mr. Lawrence was left defenseless without any corroboration. So that's my position. Right. I'm happy to answer any question about any other aspect of this case.
I have a question about intent. I think in your brief you argue that the government has to prove intent to persuade a minor, but you don't take issue with the jury instruction, and that instruction allowed the jury to convict if it found that Lawrence intended to provide an adult to cause a minor to engage in unlawful sexual activity. The jury was instructed.
That's correct. I conceded that it's not an issue, at least one of these charges is not a specific intent crime. I made that concession in my reply brief. But there's the general intent. One's general intent. The second one, I think 2423, is a specific intent crime. But when I looked at the instructions, they looked basically fairly standard to me. The real problem with this case struck me wasn't the instruction, it was the failure to have the critical corroboration for his case, where he ended up naked for all intents and purposes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Heffernan?
May it please the Court, Patricia Heffernan on behalf of the United States. Picking up, I guess, with the second issue, the question of whether it was ineffective for counsel to present Mr. Stickney at trial. We know from the record that counsel told appellant that it was a bad idea and that presenting Stickney would simply convey to the jury birds of a feather, meaning that, as the appellant explained, that they're child predators and so I must be a child predator. These are the people I associate with, which is certainly a fair association and a danger for the jury to draw. And with respect to the four words that Mr. Stickney would have testified to, his understanding or corroborating understanding of the meaning of these words, Detective Palchak testified that all of these words both have meaning in a homosexual context, conversations between homosexual men, but they also have meaning and are words used by child predators. So Mr. Stickney's testimony, which was aimed at an argument to the jury that anybody hearing these words had to have understood them to have been subtle code indicating I'm a gay man looking for another gay man to have to get involved with, wouldn't have had any traction because it would not have discredited Detective Palchak's testimony that these words also have meaning within the to child predators. These are also words that child predators use. And in fact, that his testimony is particularly persuasive because the defendant, the appellant, was on not a website where gay men are looking to meet other gay men. He was on a website and a specific part of a website where people are trying to find children to have sex with. So that's the context in which these words were used.
I can understand the argument that this might have been less than helpful have the lay witnesses testify. But what about the testimony of Dr. Berlin?
Yes, happy to move on to that as well. As an overarching matter, there was no question at trial that Mr. Lawrys was a compulsive, uncontrolled sex addict. That was his theory of the case, and that went virtually unrebutted. He testified for the greater part of a day about all, it conveyed to the jury that this was someone who spent all of his time, all day long, on the internet, trying to find sexual situations anywhere, anyplace, anytime. And so that really was, there was no dispute about that, that he was engaging in this kind of internet chat, unquestionably. There were only two specific situations that we heard about where Mr. Lawrys jumped in a car and drove somewhere to actually meet somebody. Both of those situations involved a conversation that actually was not very outlandish. It was quite specific. There was nothing outlandish in the terms of sexual activity about what he wanted to engage in. All of the conversations that the appellant described for the jury involving gay men were not on the incest taboo website in the meeting place on that website. They were on Yahoo and on Craigslist, entirely different situations. So Dr. Berlin's testimony that I diagnose him as a sexual compulsive would have added nothing to the testimony that the jury had heard. It was undisputed that Mr. Lawrys is a sexually compulsive sex addict. That wouldn't have had the kind of impact counsel is suggesting, because there really was no dispute about that. But there were only two situations that the jury heard about where appellant was on this particular website, a website for child predators and not gay men, and where appellant was actually acting on the conversation that he had. Then just briefly on the question of what counsel knew and when he knew it and what the record shows a few things. The record does not show, even if, assuming true, that Dr. Berlin at some point, let me back up a minute. According to the record, Dr. Berlin had an initial interview with the appellant, and then he conveyed to Mr. Clennon that he needed additional materials that he wanted Mr. Clennon to send. He wanted the computer to be, he wanted to see all the emails and any materials that he could look at in order to form an opinion. And according to Mr. Clennon, at the various status hearings, and I apologize to the court, we had a word limit, and so we have pared down our description of the various status hearings. But it's clear at the various intervening status hearings that Mr. Clennon is reporting to the court, I haven't been given any kind of baseline opinion. He won't give me anything to tell the court at the same time that he's asking the court for additional continuances. There's no reason on this record to believe that, even if you assume that at some point Mr. Berlin, after the interview, said to himself, I think this guy's a paraphiliac, that he conveyed that opinion to Mr. Clennon. In fact, Mr. Clennon has said, I haven't received any opinion whatsoever. So there's no record support for the notion that he told Mr. Clennon, I've got this testimony available that I can offer at trial if you want to use it. With respect to...
There wouldn't be record support. That's the purpose of having the remand for the evidentiary hearing.
Well, Your Honor, my point is...
We don't usually resolve these, at least when there's some factual dispute like this.
I agree. My only point was, I think when you read what Mr. Clennon is saying to the court, he's saying, I haven't received any opinion whatsoever. Not, I haven't received the specific opinion I'm looking for. And our overarching argument is really... Yeah, there is no prejudice. Even accepting all of this is true, the testimony of Dr. Berlin, if he had testified at trial, there is no reasonable probability that would have swayed the outcome here, given all the facts before the jury. Just as a factual matter, I wanted to...
Well, the district judge did refer to the evidence on the 24-23, at least before the defendant testified, as razor thin.
I took a... The district court's language is a little bit funny about that, and so it's
pretty clear to me.
Well, he's discussing, it's at page 286 of the May 26th transcript. And the district court starts off its MJOA ruling saying it's made no secret about this case and his discomfort with the legislation. Then he goes on, and then he switches over to a discussion of the facts of this case, and he doesn't have any problem with the fact that this is all language of persuasion, 2422B.
On the 2422, I agree with you, but then he switches to the 2423, and he said, I would probably find a reasonable doubt.
And with all due respect, with respect to...
That's before the defendant testifies, so that may change the situation.
That's right, and I do think it does change things. But with all due respect to the district court, I disagree. And I think it's important to take a look, to actually focus on the conversation itself and the way it unravels itself, or the way it's...
The only reason I bring this up is because I think you are saying the evidence is so overwhelming, there could be no prejudice, and that's a little bit in tension, more than a little bit, with this comment by the district judge.
I don't disagree with the court that that's how the district court articulated its analysis of the evidence. But I do think what's important in analyzing the evidence is to take a look at how the conversation progressed, and if the court would just indulge me briefly, because the conversations about a meeting first and then going to a bar come late in the conversation. So the way the conversation opens is at page 213 of the appendix. As soon as he finds out that this man is sexually involved with this little girl, he says, "You got to invite me over. Let me help me with the little girl." So he's already trying to get over. The agent says, "How far from you from D.C. are you?" And he immediately sees that as an opening. I can come right now. And then they discuss how things are going to happen with the little girl, how things are going to play out. And the agent says, "Just want to make sure we do it safely. Before we play with her, she would be cool with it." And then the appellant says, "Let me meet her and everything first." So the beginning of the conversation is, we're going to get together and the girl is going to be there. But there's going to be this initial period where I make sure that this is going to be safe and it's okay for you to get involved with this little girl. It's not until later in the conversation that there's this discussion about first meeting at a park or a bar and then going to, as they say, have some fun. So I think breaking out the order of the conversation, I think there's a very strong inference that the appellant thinks that this child is going to be at the apartment and this is going to be a situation of an initial... literally making sure, because right away he says, "I want to," and you're not a cop, are you? Why are they making sure they're not cops if this is nothing more than two gay men going to meet? So I think if you break down the conversation in the order it comes in, instead of taking snippets from the end and injecting them, I disagree with the district court. I think there is a very strong inference that the appellant thought that the meeting was going to be for sexual activity with the child.
Let me ask you about the Berlin report, or what the testimony would have been, and whether there was no prejudice from his not testifying. It seems to me that the defendant, when he took the stand, cooked his own goose. Now, is there anything in the record that indicates that he did that only because he couldn't get Berlin there? I mean, if Berlin had testified about what a sexual addict is, what a paraphiliac is, and so forth, and my belief is this man is one, is there anything in the record to indicate that the defendant then would not have taken the stand and described himself?
No, there's nothing in the record on that score. But there is the appellant, after he's convicted, because he obviously feels very strongly about his case and what has happened. I think it's a fair reading from the transcript, especially given how he testified and the comments that he makes. I think if there's any kind of reading of the transcript, it's that he would have testified regardless. He wanted the jury to know his story, and the only way that story was getting out was through his testimony.
Let me ask you about one condition of the supervised release, the prohibition against a camera. And Love and Sullivan, I think, were both convicted of child pornography, and that's why that camera prohibition was sanctioned. What about the fact that he hasn't had any history of pornography, has he?
I'm not sure whether, for sure, Sullivan was convicted of child pornography. We know from the record that appellant was watching, he was interested in child pornography. He was interested in finding people to get together with that had child pornography. So we know he has an interest in child pornography. He's on websites where he's fantasizing about children. And his ability to access child pornography is now going to be severely curtailed, assuming that he actually abides by his conditions of release. But more broadly, the court is looking at this on plain error review. We know that these are standard conditions. I wanted to point out, which gets me to a bigger point I want to point out, which it's important to understand how the sentencing occurred. The appellant wanted to be sentenced by Judge Robertson, who was retiring, because his guideline range was going to be well above the statutory mandatory minimum. He was looking at, according to the prosecutor, 252 to 365 months. So at the bottom of the range, an extra 4.5 years beyond what he got. At the top of the range, an extra 10 years beyond what he got. So he wanted to go to sentencing that this particular day. And that foreclosed a pre-sentence report. And what the appellant is asking for now is to have his cake and eat it too. He wanted to have sentencing on that day without a pre-sentence report, which would have told us all about appellant and which would have permitted a district court to engage in a more and address the personal characteristics more of the appellant, because he wanted to lock in the sentence. And now he wants to go back and get a new sentencing, or really what he wants is just to have these conditions reversed. At best, he would be entitled to a remand for a sentencing hearing, at which the court would address these factors and the appellant, and I suppose create a pre-sentence report so that the district court could be informed as to these particular factors, should the court have any concern about them, on plain error review. And that really, under the fourth prong of Olano, should not be permitted, because that would be unjust. That would be an insult to the fairness of the proceedings to allow a defendant to lock in a particular sentence and stand silent. And there's a reason he stood silent, because if he starts complaining about any of these conditions, the obvious answer is, well, let's do a pre-sentence report and find out whether or not each of these conditions are appropriate as to you. And he doesn't want to do that because he wants to be sentenced that day. And with respect to this, whether these are standard conditions, the court says before it goes to sentencing, it wants to take a two-minute break to go get the boilerplate language, and then comes out with two pieces of paper that he says he's going to read. So the court is reading, is imposing what is in the court's view are the standard conditions in this case, in these types of cases. Circling back around to the camera restriction.
Well, we don't know what he was reading from, right? He could have been reading from Love or Sullivan. Or did he say, I'm reading from standard?
All he said is, I want to take a break to go get the boilerplate language, is the way he terms it. That's at page 7 of the May 27th transcript.
I know you're out of town, but I did have one question. The reason that this case seems to me particularly thinned is that we have an adult intermediary here rather than a pretend minor, which we have in a lot of these cases. And there's no case, I think, in this circuit that says a defendant can be convicted under 2242B for persuading an adult intermediary.
I'm not aware that the court has written. I don't know about any unpublished cases. I'm not aware whether the court has actually written as to whether or not that constitutes a violation of the statute. Clearly, appellant has made clear he's not challenging that that does violate the statute, and I can't think of the case off the top of my head right now, but in the 11th Circuit, the court has very persuasively explained why that theory of a criminal offense is consistent with the legislation and what Congress was aiming at prohibiting. If there are no further questions, we'd ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Deckerhaus. Okay.
I'll try to respond briefly to some points that each member of the panel raised. Judge Brown, I'd be happy if you want to do a supplemental brief on this issue. Strikes me that if it's of some concern to the court, that it really ought to be of some concern to me as well as his counsel. Judge Kavanaugh, you pointed out that Judge Robertson described the case as razor thin at the close of the government's
on the,
case.
On the one count.
On one count. But I think the fact of the matter is that Judge Robertson was a pretty cautious jurist, and if he was troubled by that, I think we ought to be troubled. All of us ought to be troubled by what this record reflects, which sort of segues into what you raised, Judge Anderson. I agree that to some degree Mr. Lawry's testimony, I would hate to use the word cooking his own goose, but it wasn't very helpful to him. I don't know why. It's not clear. If I knew it, I would certainly tell you. If it was in the record, even if I had a clear sense of it, why Dr. Berlin wasn't called. But had Dr. Blinn been available, it's entirely likely that he wouldn't, Mr. Lawry's wouldn't have had to testify, but Dr. Berlin could have explained the nature of his disease to this lay jury and let them understand a little bit more. I think, Judge Brown, you asked about Dr. Berlin. I think it's that chat strikes me of these outlandish, bizarre, crazy comments made by Mr. Lawry's. I don't mean crazy in the sense of clinically crazy, crazy in the sense of speech that none of us would hope any of our kids would use, anything like that. But all of this sort of shows why Dr. Berlin would have been so helpful to defense, that people who make these comments, this is typical of people who suffer from paraphilia, of these outlandish comments made in anonymous sex. Why was he in the internet, in this incest porn? He said on the record, it's in the record, and I'll cite you the page if you want, but men tend to seeking other men tend to cruise this particular site. That's what he testified on the record. With that, I have, other than the issue of child pornography, he was never shown to have engaged in child pornography. I think that restriction is quite overbroad. He can't even go to a Barnes & Noble bookstore, really.
Let me ask you something. You have not raised the, incompetence of trial counsel because he let him get on the stand.
I did not.
Okay.
I tend not to raise these things lightly.
Do we know whether there's anything in the record that he did advise him not to?
I think there is something in the record. That he'd advise him not to? I think there is, just before he testified, there is a statement in the record, and it is in the record here, that Judge Robertson advised me he didn't have to testify. And they had a quick colloquy, and he said he wanted to testify. I don't think there's any, I can't look and tell you that trial counsel advised him on the record not to testify, or that anybody said on the record, don't testify. The problem he was faced with is the problem I think you all recognize. There was nobody there to defend him but himself. He had to testify.
Okay.
Thank you.